Well, I don't know.
Okay. I hope it goes better than the last conference call I had. So.
Well, this is only conferencing with me for
okay.
right now. I'm speaking with Dr. Arnold Kaluzny, Kaluzny, on December 18, 2008. And I have your permission to record the call?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Let me start out. Tell me a little bit about yourself, how you came to work with the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control.
Like most things in life, involves a fair amount of serendipity, to tell you the truth. I came to Chapel Hill in 1967. And working on a project that was looking at the implementation of various kinds of healthcare programs, and we defined that sort of as an organizational innovation. And as part of that project, we brought together a group of people for a conference. And one of the people happened to be at that conference was Saxon Graham. Saxon Graham was a sociologist from the University SUNY in Buffalo, who had been doing just a lot of cancer work, and social behavioral sciences, cancer control, and things like this. And we had other people at this meeting and so forth, and it was a very successful meeting, published a little paper and so forth. But he had an extended career with the division then of the Division of Cancer Control and Prevention, DCPC. And he evidently was supposed to be going on a site visit to the University of Chicago as one of these comprehensive cancer review things. And he couldn't make it. And the executive secretary, as I recall, was a fellow by the name of Wayne Hurst. And Saxon said that there was this young guy down in Chapel Hill, he's a social scientist and interested in organizational innovation. Why don't you take him on the study section? And we went up to Chicago, and it was one of these, I had a good day. I asked the right questions with the right tone. And pretty soon I sat on a number of ad hoc reviews and became a chartered member of a study section and so forth and so on. So that's how I sort of moved into the world of cancer control and prevention.
And how did you get to NIH and work with them?
Well, that's Division of Cancer Control and Prevention is of one of the divisions within the National Cancer Institute, which is one of the institutes within, as you know, the National Institutes of Health.
And so you came at just as doing this on an advising capacity or review capacity.
Right. You know, these places operate with all sorts of ad hoc study sections. And they select people from around the country based on expertise, and I think there's a regional allocation. And as it usually works, you know, people, they find people who they think can add to the complement of folks that they need on these study sections, and they put them on a site visit or something, and if you don't make a total ass out of yourself, you may get invited to be an ad hoc review, and eventually when one of these positions on the chartered study sections opens up in which they need somebody who is a social scientist or a clinician of some sort or a biostatistician and so forth, they get appointed to this either on a 2-year basis or a 3-year basis. It's a rotating kind of thing. The max is 4 years. And you travel with this group for the next, if you're on this committee, for 4 years. And actually, it's one of the highlights of my career to be on several of these charter study sections, because you get to know these colleagues very, very well, because they're the people who are reviewing the proposals that are coming in. So you have exposure to state-of-the-art science that's being conducted around the country, as well as making the decisions collectively on whether this should be funded or not funded and the priority score. So it's really something I recommend for every researcher who has an opportunity to be invited to sit on one of these study sections to say yes.
When did you do the first one of the DCPC?
Well, oh golly, it must be, I think this initial site visit was launched probably 1970 or 71. And then there was a 2 or 3 year period that I functioned sort of as an ad hoc reviewer. I'd have to go back and check exactly when I first sat on the study section. But the study section, if you've got the records probably from Linda Bremerman, was when Dr. Tim Talbot was the chairman of it. He was the president of the Fox Chase Cancer Center. Mm-hmm. And it was during his term that I was appointed to that study section for 4 years with just an unbelievable cast of characters. And we would be meeting up in Building 31 up on one of those conference rooms. Now, they reserve that for just the high-level policy people, so study sections under their current mode meet in hotels and all these other places. But at least in those days, the study section would be meeting up there in Building 31 and in the C-Wing.
And what was the nature of the office then within NCI?
Well, it was, the Division of Cancer Control and Prevention?
Yes.
It was an extramural a program in which they had a whole variety of programs. They've now, partitioned this thing off back in Rick Clouser was the director of the NCI, and he, I think fairly arbitrarily, separated the Division of Cancer Control that component of DCPC into two components, one of which was now the Division of Cancer Prevention, and the other was the Division of Cancer Control and now called Population Sciences. And that occurred, I think, probably around 96 or 97, something like that. It was a pretty traumatic split. And they created two review groups, one for cancer prevention, and the other for cancer control. And I sat on the cancer control group. A guy by the name of Albert, a sociologist from Brown University, chaired it. But it was an interesting cast of characters. Ernst Winder was on that committee, as I recall. Helena Brown. Some of the people who had been on these study sections over the years in one capacity or another. And we met for a 3 or 4 month period and then came up with a report. And probably the most significant thing of that report was the fact that it declared for the first time to my knowledge that the social and behavioral sciences were the basic science for cancer control. Okay? And they appointed Barbara Reimer as the director of that new division, and Peter Greenwald, who was the prior director of the combined division, eventually, after a fair amount of trauma and some writing and support from the external community, was appointed the director of the Division of Cancer Prevention, which is the current position Peter holds.
You say trauma. What kind of trauma?
They made, as I understand it, they being the leadership at the NCI, Rick Klausner and company, made Peter reapply for the position. Okay? He wasn't just automatically appointed that division. So he, and as a result, there was a fair amount of effort by the external community, who were very supportive of Peter, writing letters of support, and, you know, he's received during this period of time a whole series of rewards and awards of one sort or another for his work when he was the director of the Division of Cancer Control and Prevention. And eventually he was, in fact, appointed. But he was required to apply for that position, and I presume they had other people making application. And this was the trauma, because I think there was an expectation that if they split this, he would get one of the two divisions. I think he personally preferred the Division of Cancer Prevention, because this was real science, involving chemo prevention and, you know, nutritional sciences and so forth and so on. And, you know, he was no longer responsible for the social science part of that went to the Division of Cancer Control and now called Population Sciences.
And this was something, the split was, you say, engineered by NCI?
Rick Klausner was the director at the time, and I'm not sure of the logic for all that, but it was a fairly arbitrary split.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we ended up with now two extramural divisions.
In the late 90s, you were on a panel that 96-97, Special Review Group on Cancer Control. And that was after the split?
When was this?
96-97.
I think that's the panel I was talking about that defined what is cancer control provided a sort of a research agenda. Who chaired that? Do you know? Do you have that?
No, I don't. I just have you as a member.
Okay. I would venture to guess that's the one I was talking about. Okay, when they created these two separate panels to sort of come up with the review and define, you know, what is cancer prevention and what is cancer control. And that's the charge given to the committee. And in the process of doing that, set up a sort of a tentative agenda and Bob Hyatt was also on that committee, incidentally, who became Barbara's deputy. Barbara Reimer's deputy. I have no idea what happened in the other committee. I think you ought to read those two reports as background, because they were really very definitive, not only for the Division of Cancer Control and Prevention, but also for Peter's division as we know it now. It was a rather negative review of the work that had been done within the NCI for cancer prevention, and set forth in fairly stringent terms what were the problems.
And this was problems in D.C., P and C?
Well, right, and associated with Peter's leadership.
Uh-huh. And who chaired that one? Who did that?
I can't remember his name. Linda would have that. She would know.
Okay. And so it was basically an attack on Greenwald.
Yeah, it was not a friendly report.
And was it set up that way to begin with?
I don't know.
If Klausner really wanted to get rid of it?
Probably.
I understand these things have happened at NIH.
Yeah. It's a body contact sport up there.
is that why you stay in Chapel Hill?
Oh, that's right. No, I have a day job, you know. This is not my main course of activity for all these years.
Well, I thought you were emeritus now.
I am. And I spend time up there. But sometimes it's entertaining, but sometimes it's pretty traumatic.
Well, when they put the how did Peter try to reassemble the DCP? I mean, the bad review must have had some.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, so.
Well, Peter's a unique person. I don't know whether you know him very well, but I mean, he's one of the most unflappable people, a visionary, and he is truly dedicated to developing preventive oncology as a clinical discipline. And so this was his opportunity to, and he sees prevention and chemo prevention and the kinds of stuff that we now are engaged in within the vision of cancer prevention as the science base for coming up with preventive oncology.
Well, it strikes me that there's I'm not hearing something. Maybe it's
yeah. Go
late.
Ahead. I don't want to be subtle.
Here is a division which is not necessarily within the NCI mainstream. That is preventing.
Right. I think that's true.
And so, how much did NCI really know about what cancer prevention was when they issued a report?
Well, I'm not sure they knew then, nor they know now. You know, when you look at the, I remember sitting at a study session, not a study session, but I remember when they were, I think this was for the replacement of Sam Broder. When he stepped down, they had in Building 1, NIH, they were talking about the characteristics and of what the new director. And if I'm not mistaken, it was so striking to me that they never mentioned the word prevention. Okay, it was treatment and etiology and, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is the heritage of the National Cancer Institute. And so prevention, you never really, you know, really got the kind of visibility that it needs. And this has been a big problem all along. It's, you know, the fact that it's sitting there as a division, an extramural division, I think it's a fairly vulnerable unit within the larger organization. And part of that is always contingent on the priorities that the director sets forth. I think, to be perfectly honest, however, it's increasing in focus, okay, as a priority. When I first started sitting on the study section, you know, nobody around the table had a clue what the hell was cancer control or prevention. Okay, these were composed of social scientists who were interested in the social psychological aspects of A, B, and C, a bunch of clinicians of one sort, not surgeons, radiation people, and so forth and so on. And you know, cancer control was something out there, but it was not really definable in any real terms. And I think we've been able to get beyond that kind of thing. And if you look at now some of the infrastructure of NIH, we got focus on disparities, we got social science people looking at outcomes research within the Division of Cancer Control and Prevention. We're looking at delivery issues of one sort or another, the economics of healthcare with the people like Martin Brown and some of the people in the other division. The kind of work that Peter and Leslie and some of the folks have funded within their own division to look at the organizational structure of community clinical oncology program to invest in the evaluation of that kind of thing. So I think it's coming along. But obviously the mainstream is big time science in terms of disease management.
Mm-hmm. When the office got split in the, I think probably by the late 90s.
Right.
It was, and I shouldn't use the passive there, I think Peter reorganized it with perhaps some help from you.
He did reorganize it. What we had when it was split was simply a series of functional units. We had nutrition, we had C-cups, we had biostatistics, we had preventive science, one or two other kinds of things. And Peter was, and rightly concerned, was the fact that these were fairly autonomous functioning. And as we all know, the opportunities in science are always at the intersection. And the question becomes, how do you begin putting this together in a way that would have interactions such that new ideas would emerge that would be relevant to the development of prevention as a science? That was one problem that he identified, and he was absolutely right. The second problem...
Excuse me. This was not in the report.
No. This is after he was already appointed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. He's now in charge, sitting up in Executive Plaza on the second floor and so forth. And he saw this as a problem, which was, incidentally, which was somewhat of a problem before in DCPC, no doubt about that. But it became really apparent here, because prevention and chemo prevention trials and so forth, you really need to begin having these people interacting in some way. The second problem was that the division did not have really a real way of linking to the clinical community. Okay, it had C-cops out there, but it didn't have. It couldn't translate what it was doing in terms of how clinicians think about disease. You know, you got GI cancers, you got breast cancers, you got, you know, urological cancers and so forth and so on. And so, I remember vividly because it was, he came with this chart and, with little X's in it, you know, it was a 2x2 table with, X's with the horizontal, you know, being the departments, and then the vertical axis being sort of organ sites, okay, which physicians identify with, and had little X's, and he was trying to think how we could organize the division that way, and I said, Peter, that's a matrix organization, and we know how to do that kind of thing. And, you know, Peter's one of these marvelous guys who's never met an idea he didn't like, and now he had a label for it, and that's what happened, okay? That's how we ended up with this matrix thing, which is essentially how this organization was functioning from, say, 2000 till about a year ago, in which we had then the initial functional units that he had created, and then he created these research groups for GI, breast, urologic cancers, and lung, four groups with directors for each of these kinds of things. And then he created these project teams. The problem is that I saw it as these were service lines, okay? That one, just like in the pharmaceutical industry, you'd put together the functional expertise, and then it would relate as a service line to the lung research group or the breast group or the GI group or something like that. And unfortunately, everybody had to be in a project team. Well, you know, this just didn't go very far, and people sort of got exhausted by sitting in project teams and so forth and so on. And so that sort of got dismantled a little bit. And where we now are is doing this sort of on a much more leveraged basis without designating project teams, but requiring collaboration, for example, with the chemo prevention unit, which is a functional unit, across the organ site groups. We just had a retreat recently in which we're now seeing the nutritional science group sort of mandated to show how they can relate very, very specifically to the various organ site groups. We have another recommendation on the biometry group, how that will relate not only to the organ site groups, but to all the other functional groups also, which has tended to be somewhat isolated within the division. Does that help?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And what the reason behind the changes was that there are too many meetings, or
why we dismantled the thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just. But you know, it did serve a purpose. Because for the first time, people were talking to each other big time, okay? And
they had not been before.
Well, not as much as you would think. Not as much as you would
think. Sort of like an academic department.
Absolutely. You've been there, I've been there. You know, everybody's happy doing their own thing. And this forced a little bit of understanding of what other people are in fact doing, and we still are working and struggling with that in a much more explicit way than we had in the past.
And was this matrix system something that North Carolina had been doing as well?
What we did is. When we launched this thing originally, Peter and Leslie Ford and Shannon Brandon and I, maybe one or two other people came down here and came down to North Carolina, and we went talked with Dennis Gillings, who is the president and CEO of Quintiles, which is this large contract research company which does a lot of clinical trials, and spent the morning with him and his organization to see how they do things. And they based on project teams, but they based on project teams in terms of service lines, specific projects that are being developed over a period. We also went to Burroughs Wellcome, which has now been reorganized, but they also had a matrix structure. And so that's the model that we simplified but tried to apply there, and then went on the deep end that they had project teams for publications, they had project teams for all sorts of things that really didn't need to have project teams on. I mean, I think we abused the concept, and as a result it died of its own weight. But from that came the fact that we're seeing sort of leveraged relationships among the research groups and the organ site groups.
From your perspective, when the two groups were split, did a lot of the people, what did the split do to the morale, I guess, in the division period?
Well, I think there's a short term and short. That's a good question. Short term, long term. I think short term, people felt very good about that because these were all we left all the social scientist people over there. Yeah, you know, this is real science. Okay, these are, if you look at our group within the Division of Cancer Prevention, these are all PhDs in pharmacology, or they're all MDs. You don't have the social scientists running around over there doing health education behavior kind of stuff, which is probably, you know, it's tolerated, but it's not, you know, it's a different animal, okay? And that was a short-term, I think, benefit. We didn't have to deal with those folks. The thing that, and this may be just a little bit more me than other people, but I think there is some feeling, and it's generated, increasing, that some of these people we should have really taken with us. That is to say, if, and I don't know whether they had the choice. Particularly the group, some of the economists in the Health Services Research Unit, which were left over there, because increasingly the issues of cancer prevention involves questions of economics, the cost-benefit, cost-effectiveness of this kind of stuff, the measurement of this activity, and those kind of folks are much better able to deal with metrics and the economics. In fact, they've got the expertise, and we don't have the expertise in-house to deal with those kinds of things. And so I think there was some recognition that, you know, loss of that. But morale-wise, short-term, you know, moved forward.
But don't you consider yourself among the social scientists?
Well, yeah, but absolutely. I don't know why I have a special relationship with this group, but the social scientists over there involve a lot of health educators and psychology people. Myself is sort of functioning as an organizational sociologist, and it's closer to the challenges that they face because they run these large interorganizational networks. Okay, mm-hmm. If you look at the CCOP program, if you look at EDRN, the Early Detection Research Network, if you look at the consortium that is the sort of units that's dealing with the phase 1-2 chemo prevention trials involving the four organ sites. These are organizational issues, and I think that's probably my link with those folks.
And yet your perspective is step back and be a little distant. While you're part of it, you're not really
that's
quite
right.
part of it.
That's right. You know, there's a really marvelous one of the reports that I did, Forgive and Remember. Are you familiar with this book?
No, I'm not.
It's a dissertation. It's old. I don't know if I got it now, but it's a story of two surgical units within a hospital. And this guy was an anthropologist, and he lived in these two units. And the storyline is how these physicians handle failure. Okay, and you know the only way you know how to do surgery is you got to do it, and sometimes you make mistakes, you make stupid mistakes, knowledgeable mistakes, and this is where the forgive and remember kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And in there, this he has a very very nice methodological appendix, which talks about how he dealt with this kind of issue that you are in and of the organization. Okay. And how do you maintain some sense of objectivity in your study and your analysis and so forth? So I'm very sensitive to that, and in one of the reports I tried to address that because I think it is an issue if you're so close to these people. In fact, Jackie, who used to be head of the ARC, I was telling her one time that I come home, I'm just so tired because, you know, I sort of feel like the organizational psychiatrist. You know, everybody tells me all their problems and so on and so on. She says, "No, Arnie, you got it wrong. You're not the psychiatrist. You're the priest."
Uh-oh.
You know, sort of the confessional kind of thing. And so, you know, you just get to know these people and hear all this coming of problems and, you know, management and so forth. So I do think I do have a very privileged relationship with the division.
Well, when it let me go back because you were associated with the division in the early 90s,
yeah.
before the breakup.
Yeah.
And how did it function? Peter was still there then. I mean, he'd been leading it for almost a decade.
Peter. Whether he's leading the DCPC or whether he's leading the DCP, is a pretty much a hands-off manager. Okay, he believes that you get smart people and you let them do their own thing, and that's how they operated within the DCPC. And you know, this is great for people who, you know, are smart and dedicated, and he's got a lot of them doing this kind of thing. The problem is that, you know, all this occurs within a large bureaucratic organization. And I think this is probably where there's some concerns expressed at different levels.
I mean, the people at NCI don't always consider this the best management technique.
Yeah, I mean this is a big organization, and it's a very it runs pretty much like an academic department. And that's what's the beauty about it. That's also what the problem is, in terms of its ongoing day-to-day operations.
Well, one of the things that I was reading on the Matrix system,
yeah,
was that it was supposed to produce leadership.
Yeah.
Did it?
Within?
Yeah. If the system before was to produce leadership, or, you know, let you manage, you're the leader, then the system that comes in was to improve motivation. I'm sort of quoting what was said at the time, quote, motivation,
right,
leadership qualities, because these groups could emerge, they'd be stronger.
Right.
That they, what was it, communicate, and...
Right. I think it didn't produce it by itself. One of the things that, one of the reports that we did when we evaluated this, because one of the real virtues of Peter and his leadership is that while he's hands-off, he also believes in evaluation, and, you know, he launched this thing, and he proceeded to have somebody come in and look at how well are we doing with respect to the Matrix organization. Same kind of thing with the CCOP study. I mean, we developed a CCOP program, the Community Clinical Oncology Program. And he put a tremendous amount of money, and I was the PI of that project, to evaluate, you know, how is this the appropriate structure? What do we know about the management of these organizations that would help us improve the ability to accrue patients from a community hospital setting? But to your question, I think what was lacking was the fact that these are all clinicians or scientists of one sort or another who really don't have any management training at all, okay? And there have been several attempts to do that. We've been very fortunate within that division to have this guy, Ray Palmer. I don't know if they ran across him, but he's one of the very, very best OD people. Some of these guys are real marginal at best and play games and stuff like this. But Ray Palmer does a lot of stuff for the State Department, evidently, and for the United Nations and within NIH. But he's a very creative person who has been able to engage the division in terms of facilitating interactions back and forth and so forth and so on. But what's really missing, and we recommended this on this evaluation, was that we really needed to select certain people within the division to go for management training and to have it tailored, not just, you know, some kind of management training program, but to have it tailored to the kinds of issues and problems that they face within an NCI kind of environment. And if you read one of the reports that we did, I was suggesting the Center for Creative Leadership down here in, and I have no financial interest in that place, but the Center for the Center of Creative Leadership in Greensboro, North Carolina, does this kind of training for groups of people specifically tailored to the organization that they're employed in. And we were never able to get that approved. or funded at least. The report was made, the recommendations were received, so forth and so on. But I think this is what's lacking within the division.
When you say not funded from NCI?
Right, right. No. Well, you know, it was when at the time that we were hitting all these huge cuts, you know, they've taken just a tremendous beating with the funding situation. And so this never really happened. And while we had some modest training efforts, they did a 360 analysis, you know, where they take supervisors and, you know, ask your supervisor, your peers and your subordinates get a chance to evaluate you and so forth. And there's been several of those things over the years. But, you know, we're talking about a much more sustained effort to make something like that happen.
What is the impact of the scientific advisory counselors or advisory board of science, you know, change its name from time to time?
Right, the BSA.
Yeah.
The Board of Scientific Advisors.
Yeah. On the agenda of the division?
It drives the agenda. I chaired that board at one point in time. That board is composed of outside people and concepts. Remember, Phil, this is an extramural unit, okay? So they have projects which are being conducted by the extramural community. But the concepts that result in these RFPs are developed by in-house people within each of these different research groups. And they have to present the concept to get the money to support this. And usually there's big sums of money. And they present to this board of scientific counselors. And the council, and it's a very rigorous procedure. The concept is developed. It's reviewed by, now it's called a coordinating unit, which is by all the chiefs of the various research units within the division. Then it goes, Peter takes that to the executive committee, which is now composed, or always was composed, of the directors of all the divisions and chaired by the director of the NCI. And once it clears that, okay, that this is reasonable science, okay, something that's in line with what the NCI should be doing and so forth, then it goes to the Board of Scientific Advisors and gets approved there, supposedly, with a dollar figure attached to it. And, you know, you're talking about $100 million or $200, I mean, big sums of money. So this really drives the research agenda of the division. And this is a very, very rigorous group of people. Currently Bob Young chairs this thing, and in fact it's been modified from what it was in the old days because they got one board which covers both DCPC and DCP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's composed of outside people, basic scientists, clinical scientists, some patient advocates, sometimes management people. You know, it's a real potpourri of folks, and the people who present to this, I mean, it's equivalent to within the academic role of getting your PhD, to tell you the truth. And when they rehearse and practice those presentations, people wouldn't believe.
And why does the BSA cover both the divisions now?
That's just how it was organized.
So even this is post-split, or
yes, post-split. Before, every division had its own BSA.
Mm-hmm.
But with the split, one BSA for two divisions.
So was this a first at NCI?
To my knowledge. I don't know how the other ones are operating.
So what it did was force both divisions to compete against each other for the money.
That's right. That's right. And it's pretty brutal at this point. In fact, and sometimes this BSA gets involved with other kinds of projects too. I remember, probably the most traumatic time I chaired was the first time I was on the board for 4 years, 2 years as a member, and 2 years, Peter, through his ultimate wisdom, asked me to become the chair of the board. And this was an unbelievable experience because I don't know if you've been up to that room. It's a big room, got microphones. It's a big table. You're highly visible. And the first meeting I had as chair was the fact that there was this big controversy about mammography screening and for pre- and postmenopausal women, and it was presented to the board of, to the NCI, National Cancer Advisory Board, which is the policy board for the entire division, and that division said, no, we're not going to deal with this. This is a cancer DCPC problem. This recommendation has to be reviewed by the DCPC board. And so, in fact, at the time, Ed Sondick, who's now the director of the National Center for Health Statistics, was Peter's deputy. And so I arrived there pretty, nervous about chairing this board. It's a highly visible, responsible position and so forth. And he said, Arnie, we're going to have to make a change because the NCAB has requested that your committee review this mammography screening thing, and we won't have enough room for ABC, NBC, CBS cameras in Building 31. We're taking this whole thing to the Mauser Auditorium, and we'll configure it that way. And it was one of these holy shit moments, like, you've got to be kidding. But, so the whole session was devoted not to reviewing concepts. That just got delayed to the next session. And, in fact, the whole issue centered on hearing testimony in support or in opposition to this mammography screening thing. And, so the American College of Radiology was there making its presentation that, by God, every woman needs to be screened every once a year, and other people claiming just the opposite and so forth and so on. So it was a three-ring circus. It was just unbelievable. And at 3 o'clock, the camera shut down because they were had to go to press and for the news. And we went back to Building 31 with only one mobile camera, and it felt like a cozy little room. And we came up with our recommendations, and the rest was history. But the issue came back again, I think 2 or 3 years later, and was just as contentious when it was reviewed 2 or 3 years later than when we dealt with it, whenever that was. In 1980 something or other.
When you chaired it was 94-95?
Okay, that was it. 94-95. Okay. All right, this was 94.
Okay. And right at the end of your term, I would guess that that's when Klausner started to look at the
right
taking the split.
Right.
And this
right
was due in large part to your chairmanship?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I never thought of it that way. But I tell you, one of the things, though, that did happen as a result of my chairman, which I feel, or chairmanship, I feel very good about, because and one of the big problems, I think, with our division, it doesn't really get, probably because Peters is not, he's not a big showman kind of person. He doesn't get enough credit for things that he is, in fact, instituted. One of the things that was so visible when I chaired this, from my view as an organizational person, was the fact that we were funding all these concepts with sort of a view of the healthcare delivery system like it was in 1950. Okay? That here all these docs are out there in the community doing the Lord's work. Okay? Without any recognition of managed care, integrated delivery systems, the economics of healthcare and so forth and so on. And, you know, I would talk with Peter about these kinds of things. And we really need to begin thinking about research programs that are taking into account the organizational context which, of how care is, in fact, being delivered, you know. Good idea. So what we did was invite, in fact, this was the last, we would always invite somebody if we had sort of a, not a full agenda, to come and talk to the board about different things, sort of an educational thing. These meetings run for 3 days, you know, so you got 2 days, 3 days, and I think they meet 3 or 4 times a year. So, you know, it's a full agenda, but you do have some time depending upon the season and so forth. Ed Wagner, who is an epidemiologist, MD, working at Group Health in Seattle. And the issue that we asked him to talk about was the role of these large managed care systems like Kaiser and Group Health and Plymouth Health or whatever it's called now in Boston and so forth in terms of cancer control research. Well, Ed came and did a terrific job. The result of that was down the line and was the creation of what's now called the Cancer Research Network. Okay? The Cancer Research Network is located in DCCPS, okay? And when you talk to the people in DCCPS, you know, people like Bob Hyatt and so forth who weren't part of DCPC, like all this started when DCPC was created, when in fact the reality was it really started when Peter, under his leadership and interest in ideas of getting Ed Wagner to come and talk to the board, and then whatever actions occurred after that. And this has been a program that I think now it's a 5-year, it's in its 15th year, something like that, in which it involves Kaiser, California, North, South, Group Health, in Puget Sound, Henry Ford Hospital. I mean, the large integrated delivery systems and HMOs are involved in a consortium kind of arrangement doing cancer control research, you know, sharing data, which is in many times quite controversial because there's proprietary interests there and conflicts and all this other kind of business. But over a period of time, they've been able to manage that and you provide a framework for doing cancer control and prevention research within an organizational setting, which is very relevant to the delivery system.
Now, when these ideas pop up, some of them also come in from those looking for extramural grants as well, correct?
Right, that's right.
So would they be added to the agenda, or?
Well, for example, it all depends on context. When the consortium that runs the phase one, phase two trials, mm-hmm. These are the project people, are the NCI people who are involved with this are out in the community, and they are in fact helping doctors. They're very interested in promoting cancer prevention research and will help community physicians prepare proposals, respond to individual RFPs that they send out, stuff like this. So it goes both ways, without a doubt. And within the CCOP, you mean there's a very elaborate structure because within the CCOP program, local physicians operate through these consortium groups. And the consortium groups have their own organ sites which are developing research proposals which then go into NCI for approval, okay? Mm-hmm. And some get approved, some get disapproved. And then our protocols for both cancer prevention and control that accrue patients through the participating CCAPs.
One of the things that's interested me that I've noticed is that many of the division directors in DCP now are also on editorial boards of the journals. Is that something that happened when you first were associated with them? Because what I read now is, of course, much more recent. But it does allow them to keep a pretty good finger on the pulse.
Give me an example.
Well,
chiefs within
division chiefs are also serve on editorial boards.
Division chiefs within NCI
of DCP.
Oh, okay. I mean, you're talking about research.
Branch chiefs.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are serve on editorial boards.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Has that been a long tradition? Or something new?
No, I think that's they're pretty active in their own discipline kind of thing. I don't think it's recent. I mean,
okay.
And as you know, many of these people have clinical practice at the NIH hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're practicing. Laura Minucci is a practicing oncologist, Eva Salber is a practicing oncologist in the hospital and so forth. So, many of these people maintain a clinical practice and are very active in the academic world.
Well, I've noticed you've done a lot of consulting internationally.
Yes.
How does this office crack up to other countries' efforts on cancer prevention?
Well, it's funny you ask, because last week I was in Paris, I told you that.
Right.
In France, they've just instituted the first federally funded school of public health. And as part of that, that school is very interested in developing some kind of collaborative relationship with the French, equivalent to the French Cancer Institute. And the protocol business here was rather interesting because they just couldn't say, why don't you invite Arnie over and talk a little bit about some of the things he's, you know, we're doing at NCI. They worked it out so that they would ask me to ask Dr. Niederhuber to write a letter to the director of the French NCI to inform him that Dr. Kluzny was going to be there and that he, you know, perhaps could share some of the activities that he's doing with various divisions of the NCI and so forth and so on. It's rather, you know, circuitous kind of thing. But in any case, I met, they scheduled about an hour and I had about 2.5 hours with several people over there. And it's kind of interesting. That institute, for example, is mainly a coordinating mechanism, okay, of various activities, whereas, you know, our NCI is doing big-time research, both extramurally and internally. But they're dealing with the same issues, at least in the little world that I travel in. I mean, how do you change practice patterns within local communities? They're very interested in guidelines at this point. Well, essentially, DCP has given up on guidelines. There was the early program called CHOP, Community
Yes.
Hospital Oncology Program, that Jerry Yates started, and I was on sort of an oversight committee. I'll never forget this, because this was a committee, or the CHOP program was a committee to set up, or a program to set up local community physicians by disease site to develop guidelines so that, you know, relevant physicians would comply with guidelines that they had a role in participating in, right? And as I said, the NCI is always follows up with this evaluation, and the data came back, and it's published in a paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology that the only person who was in fact following the guidelines were the chairman of these committees. Well, Yates just about went ballistics in the room when he saw that and killed that program flat away. I mean, it was dead. And it was a big program because these CHOPs had already created an association because they were getting money for running these little guideline committees within selected hospitals and so forth. So they had a real vested interest. But the data was quite clear that it wasn't doing anything in terms of changing practice patterns. And that was sort of the precursor then to the community clinical oncology program, that the feeling was the only way to change practice patterns or only way to improve care within local communities was to get state-of-the-art protocols to communities. And so they funded back in the early 80s, whatever the case may be, these CHOPs, which would, first of all, focus on treatment. That was the first generation of CCOPs. Second generation had to do both protocols to treatment and to prevention. And the rest is history, because this is clearly a very, very successful program.
So this is in effect saying that the others are not into prevention as much as the United States?
Well, they approach it a little bit differently than we do. Because this other program I'm involved in, which is not a DCP program, but a program that was mandated by Dr. Niederhuber, called the NCCCP program, which is really quite controversial within the Division of Cancer Prevention, because the first thought was, why not give this money, which is a much more elaborate program than simply clinical trials, to the CCOPs and expand the role of the CCOPs into other areas such as interdisciplinary care and survivorship and, you know, biospecimen and CA big and so forth and so on. And when I was in France talking about this, one of the things that they were doing in this NCCCP program was to try to institute interdisciplinary committees for all cancer patients in French hospitals. Okay? And they looked at me and said, we just mandated it by law. So, you know, these people are approaching these things really quite differently. But I don't think there's any other country which is as elaborate or as sophisticated or as committed to cancer research on all dimensions than the NCI. But the NCI does have, or DCP in particular, and I'm sure the other divisions also, collaborative relationships with some of the other countries. I know Leslie Ford who heads up the urology research group. I can see him. Howard Parnes has a very, very close working relationship with folks in Italy. Mm-hmm. In fact, they run back and forth there all the time. And there may be some with one or two other countries, but I know the Italy, Leslie got this huge award for her work in collaborating with the Italian government on some large clinical trials that they were doing.
And Peter himself stays in the background on this?
No, he does some international things, but he's really quite generous with his people, and you know, he facilitates this, but you know, he doesn't have to showboat it.
All part of management style.
Yeah, I mean, he is, like I said, a very laid back kind of person, which is both good and bad.
I guess you hinted at this, but let me just go back, just clean up a little bit on it. The Division of Cancer Prevention has how has its place changed in NCI over the years you've been associated with it?
It's had a difficult time. It really has. Partly, I don't know the chemistry of it, but it's never been an easy working relationship with any of the directors. That may be talking out of school, but it's there because it's such an important kind of thing. But it has not really.
This is directors of NCI, not
right,
not,
right.
Not
you know, no, Niederhuber and Krauser and von Aschenbach and so forth and so on. Partly is that the other divisions are so big and so powerful that they just take up all the air. And, you know, in fact, when you think about some of the very recent developments that they had to pull the Select project, okay,
mm-hmm.
which is their big vitamin deal.
Right. Millennium, yeah.
This has to hurt, you know, because that was, you know, that's a major initiative within the DCP. We have a chemo prevention nutrition science kind of thing, and this was the budget $115 million or something like this. I mean, that they would have loved to seen that as a win-win. Now they'd have some other wins, the tamoxifen, you know, so forth and so on, gets a fair amount of thing. But what's happening within the division now, or within NCI, is if you take Dr. Niederhuber and you take the division, you know, he has a different view of how science is going to move forward. Now, he's a political appointee, so we don't know what's going to happen January 20th. But he's got a chart I should send you, because it does explain a lot, in which he talks about the transition that, hold on a second, let me just get it so I can tell you what it is straight. He's got this diagram, paradigm shift, in which he talks about 20th century paradigm, which is based on search and destroy. Okay, so we're doing these large clinical studies of 70,000 people to do, seeing whether we can prevent increased mortality or decreased mortality and morbidity associated with this. And then he's got the new paradigm. Instead of search and destroy, it's target and control. And in the middle is the whole development of proteomics and genomics and synthetic biology and sort of the new science. And, you know, I think, you know, what we're doing is sort of classic science with large randomized clinical trials that you need big bucks, big organizational structure, to be able to discover preventive agents that would reduce certain kinds of cancers. And what he's talking about is miraculous science that would be able to target, sort of evidence-based, low toxicity, a whole different way of looking at these kinds of things. And so this is, I think, really has hurt the division as it's tried to sort of address some of his focus, at the same time that they're driving this huge battleship with these large programs like EDRN, PLCO, CCOPS, the drug phase one consortium, and so forth and so on. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing. And you know, one, this would not be, in my judgment, all that big a deal if we didn't have this unbelievable cost constraint. Because, in a sense, and Peter has said this himself, this new paradigm is a gamble. We know the old paradigm works, okay, because that's how science is. We thought selenium and vitamin E and it, you know, was a very, very, you know, str- strict review to before this project ever got funded was the way to go. Well, you know, we don't know unless we do a randomized clinical trial. And the history of the P4, which was the logical extension of the breast cancer thing, which would take it to another drug, was canceled. And as a result, you know, we won't know the final answer on that kind of thing, but the next logical step was to test whatever agent was being compared with the standard practice at this point. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is the kind of, you know, as a scholar in the history of science, is how you how the classic clash between these two paradigms.
It's not the first time we've had paradigm shifts.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the issue is, these other guys, if they're going to move this way, they better be right, because in the process, they're, you know, you're dismantling an infrastructure that, you know, permits us to do these large trials and permits us to come up with these biomarkers of one sort or another, and the repositories necessary to collect material and then follow a population for 20 years and see exactly, you know, whether certain interventions were effective or not in reducing mortality and morbidity.
Well, it's also an interesting point of how good the extrapolations become out of the other paradigm.
That's right.
Paradigm. And,
that's exactly right.
NIEHS has been had that when they first got funding cuts. They went to smaller programs, and you know, more extrapolation, less testing on live animals and
right,
things like
right.
that.
Right, right. Well, I mean, this is classic, absolutely classic, and it makes it so painful is the fact that best of all possible worlds, you'd want to ease into this thing and not destroy what you know works.
That's right. I can think of a couple other examples, as a matter of fact, things that I've looked at. Tell me, what have we left out?
Well, it's about time for me to close. I don't know. What are you going to do with this?
This goes into the historian's office, and I don't know what will happen.
Okay.
They've just asked me to do these interviews.
Okay. You're just the conduit.
The pipe.
Well, what's been left out? I think, obviously, the vision that I think is the underlying dynamic within DCP is that preventive oncology is the future, and Peter's very dedicated to doing that, and plus colleagues within the division are very committed to doing this kind of thing. But it operates within a larger organization which has its own priorities, and it shifts from time to time, which is good and bad. But how this whole thing sorts out, I think, is a question of time and resources. And unfortunately, I think one of the big challenges in the division is, and I've talked with Peter about this, is simply succession planning. I mean, who is going to have this vision? You know, Peter is as old as I am, 70, I think. Who's going to have this division? Who's going to have this vision? And have we cultivated, your question earlier, the leadership within the division that would be able to carry us forward? And without that, I think there's risk that, you know, this thing could go latent for a while, but it's going to come back one way or the other, simply because, and a good model is heart, lung, and blood. I think what they've done on the cardiovascular is almost the vision that we would like to see within cancer prevention. You know, the whole business of biomarkers, you get your lipid panel, get your blood pressure tested, and we got pills that one can, in fact, lower your low cholesterol and maximize, theoretically, your HDLs and so forth and so on. And I think that's a model that is implicit, if not explicit, in the minds of some of the people who are busily trying to do science within the Division of Cancer Prevention.
So it's not only leadership within, it's whether it'll be recognized from within the NCI.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, all these directors have, you know, they all bring their own agenda, and they're, you know, very committed and very, very bright people. But it's a little bit like steering this huge boat. It doesn't turn around easily. On the other hand, it's a very dynamic organization over a period of time, and potential of accomplishing great things, and also potential of doing some harm, I suspect.
Well, has Peter done any succession planning?
I raise that. Presently he's thinking about it. We have talked about it, and I think other people have talked with Peter about it. And I think it's a major issue. We had a retreat just this past November as we were thinking forward, because under the NIH rules, and I understand all the directors of the various institutes have been requested to submit their resignation. Okay, that's just standard operating protocol. And we had a retreat talking about what are some of the scientific priorities that Peter will need to emphasize when he meets with the new director of the NCI, and may in fact be Niederhuber might get reappointed. But in any case, the protocol demands or requires that at some point Peter gets to do his little elevator talk along with all the other division directors. Of what are the priorities for the division in the years ahead, and how that squares and aligns with the director of the institute will, in fact, determine where the future is. And part of that is going to be Peter's own personal plans for providing leadership planning for succession planning for his replacement.
Good point. Mm-hmm.
So I think he's thinking about it, and but I think probably it's going to receive a fair amount of urgency shortly.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation, and I will get all things. We'll get it transcribed. And
so, what do I do with this? You know, we've had a frank and far ranging kind of thing. I don't want to say something that's liable.
I don't think you have, as a matter of fact. What is it? The man said that truth is the first defense against libel.
Right. Well,
I think this has been very, very helpful and helped me understand it, and I appreciate your perspective as someone standing a bit outside the center.
Who have you talked to, or who do you plan on talking with?
I've talked with a number of people, with Leslie Ford, Laurie, with Vern Steele.
Well, Jim left, which is unfortunate because Vern is, I think, acting for chemo prevention, CD, chemo prevention group.
And I'm leaving somebody out, and Ed Sondick later on. John Milner. And Barry Kramer.
Barry Kramer and Ed Sondick, to be sure.
Yeah.
Because both those guys are just excellent.
Good.
Well, enjoyed it?
I appreciate it. So have I. Thanks very much, and the best for the holidays.
Okay. Same to you.
Thank you. Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.